Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. And Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go so that they may celebrate a festival to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has revealed God's self to us. Let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God, or God will fall upon us with pestilence or sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their work? Go get to your labors." Pharaoh continued, "Now they are more numerous than the people of the land, and yet you want them to stop working?" That same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people as well as their supervisors, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have been made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. That is why they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifice to our God.'"
Can you see strength in my eyes? I used to sleep through the night. Then horror came, there were no lights, no sirens, just guns. It was violent and we had to run or die. I'm
excited to be here with you this morning. I was trying to get myself acquainted and familiarized with The Table, the United Methodist Church, and what you've been doing here. And it's incredible to all the work and things your church is tending to, and how engaged you are, and how there's always, I checked that page where you can sign up for coffee hour, for this and the other, and it was like, that's the life of the church. And keep you engaged is a great opportunity for leadership and going beyond the walls to live the gospel outside the walls. And you're going to go and get an orientation at the border and everything that is happening. It's just a really great place, your church. And I'm very honored to have been invited here this morning. I want to relate the passage in Exodus to my journey north, my journey to the United States. I am no Moses, and certainly I'm no Pharaoh, but I'm a member of the immigrant community. And this community is often demonized and dehumanized by those now in power. I believe that we have a modern Pharaoh ruling the United States right now. And this president, to me, doesn't seem to care much about what a loving God wants from us. that divine command to love one another like God has loved us. God wants us to recognize the divine essence in everyone, regardless of what country we are from, what language do we speak, what food do we eat, and what God do we serve. For me, the idea that only those born in the U.S., English speakers, straight, that only those interests are important, to me, that idea is rooted in white supremacy. And it's often the rationale used to make immigrants, blacks, LGBTQI folks, a threat to others. It converts these groups into people that need to be feared. And for this Egyptian ruler, it was ridiculous and unreasonable to believe that the Israelites needed time to rest and some time to worship, because the labor force was key for the comfort of the ruling class. For Pharaoh, these people have no rights and have no say. And who was this God commanding him to let them go? When those in power don't recognize the voice of God calling us to be humane, compassionate, kind to one another, cruelty gets its way. And in this story, Pharaoh, as you see, sends his slave drivers to make the work harder for the Israelites. The Israelites are to produce the same number of bricks, but they weren't going to be given the materials necessary. My first career, as mentioned by your pastor, was as an attorney at an immigrant worker center in Long Island, New York. I was fighting cases of wage and hour, restaurant workers who have no breaks and a 12-hour shift, domestic employees who were promised a green card, but no salary was given to them for years. Construction workers that were picked up at a corner for working weeks to no end and then giving no wages. And that's what I was doing. And this made me understand that exploitation has existed since the beginning of time. And those seeking only profits disregard human dignity. President Trump has reduced the number of people getting refuge and asylum in the United States to a history low. His reasoning and that of his followers is that refugees are a danger, a burden to this country, that they don't enrich this nation, that they come here to steal jobs, steal resources. This xenophobic worldview is limited, very insensitive, and especially is ignoring that the U.S. foreign policies and wars funded by the U.S. are a main reason of the displacement and desperation of people around the world. I lived through one of those wars that the U.S. was funding. I was 10 when the war started in El Salvador. I learned very early in life to live in a war zone. I learned, and my playmates also learned, what to do when shootings were happening. Our teachers and elders taught us that we needed to lie flat in our stomachs and wait until we didn't hear more bullets. And then we can get up and come back to our activities and continue playing. And strangely enough, this became our lives. We adapted. If the shooting was happening and we were outside our homes, we knew what to do. We run into the closest structure that could provide us protection. We will lie down on our stomachs until things calm down. We will get up, dust off ourselves, and either go home or continue playing. And the U.S. at the time in the 80s was giving El Salvador $1 million a day to wage war against its people. The threat of communism was that communism was going to spread throughout Central America was something the U.S. was trying to prevent. Nicaragua has had already in 1979 won its revolution, and El Salvador was expected to be next. And this is where my story coming to the United States begins. Imagine a 14-year-old girl with extracurricular activities, with friends she plays every day, a member of a chess club, a happy 14-year-old with aspirations to become the first female president of El Salvador, a total dreamer who believed that in El Salvador, people could get out of poverty, that she was seeing every day, everywhere, and that could be education can be a right for all. I was that girl. And my father, who happened to be a guerrilla member and will come in sporadic visits to see us, will tell me about his fight. And he told me that he was fighting so in El Salvador, the dream of a poor kid to become a doctor was not just a dream, that it was that could be a reality. And those little seeds were being planted, and I also was seeing figures like Monsignor Romero getting up from the pulpit, and we used to listen to him every Sunday, denouncing the repression that was happening at the time. His homilies will end, and then he will start reading the names of the disappeared and the massacres that were happening in the country. It was incredible. I listened to his homilies now as an adult, and I cannot believe somebody dared to speak the way he spoke in El Salvador of the 80s. It was at this time that my mother and my aunt decided we needed to leave El Salvador. It was not safe. And my aunt had already left El Salvador in 1976 and had secured herself permanent residency, and she was living in New York. And so in 1982, during the war years, my mother was able to join her. She secured a tourist visa and joined her in New York. But my brother and I stayed in El Salvador. And although my mother had made sure every neighbor had an eye on us, believe me, we had a curfew. We were alone, but we weren't running wild. They were watching us. It was a very tight community where I grew up. So they were caring for us, but my aunt decided we cannot leave those kids there in El Salvador. We're going to go and get it. And so my aunt, who was the only person in the family that could travel back and forth legally, decided to go to El Salvador. She arrived, gets herself in a smuggler, and says, okay, we're going north. And so in March of 1983, my brother and I jumped into a pickup truck to join a group that was coming to the U.S. without documents. It was a group of 20 people, and my aunt was traveling with us at every moment, protecting my brother and I, my brother was 13, I was 14, as I mentioned before. There were other young people in the group. Paquito was only 5, and he couldn't stay still because we had to travel by bus for days traveling through Guatemala and Mexico. So they keep from Paquito's mother keep promising him he was going to get to Disneyland so that he could be quiet. But Disneyland wasn't waiting for us. Let me tell you, you're going to see. It was far from that. What we wanted then as immigrants is not different of what people trying to get to the U.S. wants now. We wanted a safety. We wanted a new life free of danger. We wanted a bright future. And like the Israelites, we wanted a taste of freedom and wanted to see what peace looked like. Our trip coming north got very risky. Once we got to Mexico, After we started traveling away from Mexico City to the northern part of Mexico, our group immediately got targeted as a group trying to cross the U.S. border. And so we feared and we started hiding from Mexican authorities of anybody who could target a group like ours. When our group arrived in Tijuana, the smuggler told us to stay in the house and that he was going to go and bring our clothes to the laundromat because all of us only had one change of clothes. We were told to just pick up a pair of shoes and go. So immediately right after he left to do that errand, the Mexican police raided the house where our group was. And we think up to this day that he turned us in because he wanted to ask our relatives for money, pretending that he had already crossed our group. And that is a practice. They do all kinds of things. Now, smugglers are actually kidnapping people in the way north. So our group was taken and we were put in a jail cell in Mexico. And it was the 20 of us with no food, with no bathroom. There was only a drain in the middle of the room. And if somebody needed it to use it, we will cover that person to use it. And I remember there was a small window and I would look up and I would hope to be outside. I wanted it to be outside. And so what ended up happening is after they identified our group was a group of Salvadorians and they were threatening us to sending us back to El Salvador, the Mexican authorities, this group of police, asked us for a bribe. They were paid a bribe. And then they themselves took us to a friend of a group of smugglers, friend of them. So we were transported to this set of smugglers that were friend of the police. And we were with this group of smugglers that were completely mafiosos. They were really dangerous people. They keep threatening us every moment they could, that we couldn't run away from them because our life was on the line and that they were wanted. They were wanted by the FBI for killing people. So I was very terrified. And one of the nights staying with this group of smugglers, they decided they were going to attempt to cross us over to the U.S. So they took the group next to the fence that divides the U.S. and Mexico, and they had us lying down on the Mexico side until the border patrol cleared the way for us to jump the fence and start walking. It was a very cold night. I never have felt that much cold in my bones like that night. I was shaking in cold, and I had never been that cold. I never remember a day being that cold. As soon as the border patrol cleared the way for us, a coyote says, okay, let's jump the fence, and we started walking. What felt 3 or 4 hours, we were walking, hiking little hills, going down in forest. There were bushes and we were walking towards U.S. territory, and we were already trying to get to a highway when the U.S. Border Patrol detected our group in movement, and the coyote that was leading our group said, run, hide. And so we went in different directions, and my aunt grabbed my hand, and we went under a bush. And within minutes, a helicopter arrived to the area and illuminated the entire area. And they started picking up one by one, each one of us. And they got our group and they put us in a van where we spent the entire night, the 20 of us, no food, no water, no bathroom. And it was a very dehumanizing experience because we were treated like animals. And I just remembered that the way I cope with it is that I remember feeling really out of my body. And I remember looking at myself from above, looking at that little person, that little teenager in the van, sitting there next to other people, but not feeling that I was in that scene. I guess that was a way of protecting me from living through it. But it's something that I will never forget, and that informs my vision for justice. Remember, we were not rapists. We were not thieves. We weren't trying to invade the U.S., as sometimes is proclaimed in the presidential campaigns. We were human beings trying to flee a civil war that was being paid and funded by the United States in our own country. And I want you to hear 3 minutes of a clip that was done in commemoration of the Jesuits that were killed in El Salvador. So you, and I know many of you who have done solidarity work will know those times, but so that you understand what the times were like. So thank you for helping me. And the sound, we will listen to 3 minutes.
Salvador. American freelance journalist Mary Jo McConaughey heard that something horrible happened overnight.
We knocked on the door and saw what looked to be the forms of bodies under a sheet.
Reporters were talking in hushed tones, their cameras clicking. There on campus were the bodies of 6 prominent Catholic Jesuit priests. Also, their cook, Elba Ramos, and her 16-year-old daughter, Selena. They were modern-day martyrs in one of the most high-profile religious crimes in recent Latin American history.
A woman stopped us, and she said, "Tell the truth about what the armed forces are doing here." And then she just burst into tears.
Tomorrow marks 30 years since that day in that courtyard.
What's sacred ground?
NPR's Danny Hajek has the story. And just a warning here, this piece begins with the sound of gunfire.
Outside the walls of the Central American University, El Salvador was being torn apart by civil war. NPR's Alan Tomlinson was in the capital in 1989, caught in the crossfire between leftist guerrillas and the Salvadoran army.
We ourselves came under fire from a sniper.
During the 1980s, the United States sent over $4 billion to El Salvador's anti-communist military regime. But El Salvador's military, supported by the U.S., kidnapped, tortured, and killed innocent civilians.
There were always bodies being discovered in the dumps.
Victor Avalos reported in El Salvador in the 80s.
Young, old women, men, and the theme was, for a lot of people, was that life was sort of cheap.
And the murders at that university 30 years ago, these were Jesuit priests. Ignacio Ellacuría, Ignacio Martín Baró, Segundo Montes, Amando López, Juan Ramón Moreno, and Joaquín López y López, some of the top scholars in El Salvador, known for ministering to communities caught in war zones.
They were speaking for people who are too afraid to speak. You know, they had the mic at that time. They could deliver this message, which was, this is wrong.
This violence against the poor, and the country heard the priests' calls for social justice, including those who wanted them dead.
Whoever was viewed as the enemy was the enemy, and it didn't matter whether they were a clerical caller or not.
Priests and nuns who stood with the poor were targets accused of communism. Right-wing death squads had a mantra back then: be a patriot, kill a priest. One of the murdered Jesuits, Segundo Montes, once spoke to NPR.
All of us, todos tenemos que arriesgar un poco.
We all must risk a little, he said. On November 16th, 1989, the reports came flooding out of El Salvador.
6 Jesuit priests from Central American University were tortured and murdered in San Salvador.
6 Jesuit Roman Catholic priests were tortured and assassinated.
A question loomed over all of this. Did anyone know the truth?
Thank you. So those were the times, and we were trying to come to the United States so that we could be safe. So the next day after being in the van during the night, the Border Patrol put us out into Tijuana side. So we went back to Tijuana and we were back to the place where we were staying with the mafioso smugglers. And my aunt began to worry because she thought, oh, they don't know what they're doing. We're never going to cross this border. So my aunt, who's the matriarch of the family, Tia Maria, she's 81 now and still strong. And she's just been the rock of my family. She decided she was going to sort out a different group to try to cross us. So she asked my mother to lend some money, wire the money to Tijuana. And then she started negotiating with the coyotes that were keeping us captive and asking us to, we were going to leave to another set of coyotes that she has heard could finish the job. And I got super scared because they took her into a room, and I was like, what if something happens to Tia? What's going to happen to my brother and I? So I went to a patio and I kneeled down and I started negotiating with God because, you know, I was a good Catholic. That's what Catholics do. I started saying, you know, God, I know I haven't been in mass. I haven't confessed. I'm going to come back. I promise to come back every Sunday. But please let us go to the U.S. Let us cross that border. And, you know, of course, prayer has something to do with that, but my aunt, too, was able to get us out of that situation. And she was able to get us from this set of smugglers to another set that was told to her could help us out. And it was true. That night, after we had paid our ransom to go from this place to the other, this set of coyotes took us to the fence again. We jumped the fence. They had us walking what felt like 20 minutes. And then they told us to lie down in the grass that was very close to a freeway. And then next thing I know, they are saying, to the cars. We jump into some cars. And then we arrive to San Diego, to a safe house of people who crossed the border. And we made our way to New York to be reunited with my mother. We got reunited with her on April 24, 1983, and we ate pizza that day. And I wanted to fulfill my promise to God. So I went to a Catholic church nearby, and I asked the priest to for confession, and then I said to the priest, I want to, you know, be a good Catholic, but I want to know why there are so many religions in the world. I was, you know, young people are inquisitive. You know, I love the energy of young people because you want to know things. But this priest said, no, actually, your questions will be answered if you come to Mass. Just come to Mass. And I was like, okay, that's what he says, I will come to Mass. But then something random really happened. We ended up living in an apartment complex next to a Latino Baptist church. And one day I spotted my bilingual teacher, my ESL teacher, going into that church. And so when we were in school, I said, what do you need to do to go to that church? And she's like, come, Sunday 3 p.m., just come and join us. I entered into that church, and I stayed in that church for 10 years. That became my community. There were other Salvadorian immigrants like myself. Services were in Spanish. I was giving opportunities to be a leader in that community. That space was safe. I wasn't being discriminated as an immigrant outside those walls. I was. Sometimes at school, kids will call my brother and I wet bags, and they told us the Salvadorians must be number one wetbacks because they were coming a lot during the 80s. And so church was a very important piece of my life, and it became a very important piece of my life to a point where I became fundamentalist, Baptist, born again, homophobic, Christian. And it was saving me of many things, but it wasn't saving me from myself. because I was repressing who I really was. I was repressing being a queer person. And it was a high price to pay for the other comforts that faith community gave me for many, many years. At age 19, trying to fit as a straight woman, I married a man. And we became the ideal couple. He was a deacon, and I was a deacon's wife. And people needed to look up to us as people who live out good faith. But a few years into that marriage, I felt like I was suffocating. I felt like I was dying. I remember fasting for 24 hours. I will fast and pray, God, kill me or change me. I remember that my fasts, I'm a foodie. I love food too much. So when I was praying, all I could think of was roasted chickens. And it will cross like that. So I think that's why God didn't do that miracle. I wasn't that faithful. I was always thinking of food. And left me being a lesbian. Thanks be to God. So it wasn't that turmoil when I decided I was going to talk to my husband. We looked for couples counseling. And after a year of doing that, I decided I needed to divorce him. But the church turned its back on me. And I was no longer welcome in that church that had been my cradle. It has been the place where I have formed my community. And I was in exile of a community of faith. And for many years, I didn't have a church. And then at some point between my relocation from New York to California to do community organizing, I started seminary at the Pacific School of Religion. Not really with the intention of becoming a pastor, but something was guiding me. And so I finished my education in 2003 and I spent some years discerning. And then when the moment came, it was clear to me, I wanted it to become ordained, to start the first Spanish-speaking, open and affirming to the LGBTQ Latino community church. That if I was going to lead a church, that was going to be the church. And many people during my ordination meetings with the United Church of Christ used to ask me, but how is that going to happen? And I used to say, well, there is a need, so the need will respond to itself and it will happen. And here we are 8 years later, thriving as a faith community where we have the entire spectrum of the LGBTQI and plus community in our ranks and also straight allies. And there we are, making sure people feel welcome, embraced, and know that the God we serve is bigger than what our minds can understand. And last year I decided I was going to quit my secular job to go into full-time ministry because I had been serving this church on a volunteer basis. And I talked to my wife and I said, hey, can you support me? Because I have no money to be a pastor. Luckily, we made a plan. And luckily, she's a Kaiser Permanente employee, and her health benefits cover me. So that made it definitely much easier for me to jump into this leap of faith. And since I've been serving the church full time, I've been doing more work similar to what you're doing, accompanying recently arrived immigrants, and the work with this community is really hard. And one of the things I learned is that sometimes I feel like I'm not doing enough because the needs are so much, emotional needs, psychological needs, legal representation, they need so much, economic support because they cannot work during their time where the case is being resolved or other circumstances. But I have learned that the tiny bit I can do wasn't there before, so it's better than zero. So that tiny bit is is something people really appreciate and that we can all do. And that we cannot do it alone, because I have paired up with other pastors in the area to do the work, the accompanying work, because doing it alone, I wouldn't last. And I also learned that immigrants are no different than any other group, and that we come here broken. Sometimes people act out of their trauma, and that we cannot expect angelic, exemplary people when people have come through so much pain and suffering. I have a family that have ended up homeless several times. It's two small kids, 2-year-old, 6-year-old, and a mom who's 29. And all they want now is to get back to El Salvador, although the mom's brother got killed by a gang. But they see no hope. And my job will be to accompany whatever process her autonomy and self-determination is. And I have an intent to humble myself and let grace happen. Beloved, we are all agents of history, and we are all leaving a legacy. Many of you probably already have that set and have left a legacy of justice. And similar to Pharaoh, one day we are going to be invited to the moment of liberation, and we need to say yes. And someday we are going to be invited to break chains of people who are oppressed, and we better say yes. And one day we're going to be asked to share our freedom so that our world is a just, more just world. And I hope we say yes. Amen.
Don't you let go of your dreams today. Don't you let go of your dreams. Don't you let go of your dreams today. Don't you let go of your dreams. Don't you let go of your dream.
Don't you let go of your dream. Don't you let go. Don't you let go.